Welcome, or welcome back, as the case may be. This is our panel posing the question, is the modern Congress doing more harm than good? I am Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups here at the Federalist Society. It's my pleasure to welcome you, and I'm also moderating this panel. We're going to have opening remarks from each of our four panelists, beginning at that end of the table and moving this way, of 8 to 10 minutes. And then, as always, we'll have a little discussion, and we'll be looking to the audience for questions. So think of those questions, and we'll be using these floor microphones. So if you have a question when we get to that part of the program, please use the floor microphone. We're recording, so we need to get you on the microphone. In addition to what you see in the program in terms of the titles for our speakers, I'm going to just give a couple data points for each. I think every one of them is a return guest, if not to this particular conference, at least to the Federalist Society. So I thank them all for what they're doing here today and what they've done for us in the past. We're going to hear first from Adam White. He is a prolific author, a litigator of complex cases, including he played a role in the challenge to the CFPB case. And he has in the past most notably worked for Boyden Gray and Associates. Boyden's here somewhere in the room, I know. There he is. So thank you. Thank you for being here, Adam. We're going to hear second from Professor Lisa Heinzerling. She specializes in many things, but including, most notably for our purposes today, administrative law and the economics of regulation. And she published several books, including a leading case book on environmental law. Very pleased to have her with us today. We're going to hear then from Matt Spaulding. He's at Hillsdale, but at Hillsdale means, in his case, here in Washington, D.C., where he oversees the Kirby Center of Hillsdale College. He's also the best-selling author of the book, We Still Hold These Truths, and that's available at bookstores everywhere and on Amazon. And then finally, we're going to hear from Elizabeth Wydra. She is of the Constitutional Accountability Center right here in Washington, D.C. She's also a Supreme Court litigator. She's argued several important cases on topics including immigration law, habeas corpus, and sovereign immunity. She has also appeared on as served as a legal expert for NBC, ABC, PBS, CNN, Fox News, the BBC, and the list just goes on. So I'll stop there. But with that, let's get started with opening remarks. Adam White. I think up here is preferable, but not required.
Thanks, Dean. Thanks, everyone, for being here today. It's especially an honor to be on a panel with a friend and mentor, Matt Spaulding. And Matt is going to, I'm sure, cover the theory and history of this much better than I ever could. So if you don't mind, I'll tell a couple of stories, which I think illustrate what I think is wrong with the modern Congress. They both arise from recent congressional hearings that I saw. The first was a hearing before the Senate Commerce Committee, the full committee. It had to do with the question of modern regulation or overregulation, but it came right on the heels of the, I think, first executive order on immigration. And I was struck by how many of the Democratic senators criticized the immigration orders and pressed the panelists, prominent lobbyists, to denounce these orders and denounce the powers that the president was exercising. And I wanted to stand up and say, don't you see? Congress vested these powers in the president. You handed all this power to the president. And now you're left to sort of sit back and hope that a given president exercises it the way you want him or her to. They didn't notice the irony of it. I hope others did. The second hearing had to do with the House Financial Services Committee, a subcommittee. It was about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. And congressman after congressman, in pressing the witnesses and in defending the CFPB, celebrated Dodd-Frank and their achievement in the Dodd-Frank Act, which primarily just handed immense power to an unaccountable agency. It was interesting to see so many congressmen celebrating so eagerly their handing away of their own power and making themselves largely irrelevant. They took that as a victory. I think it's wrong. Those are what I think Congress is doing wrong, handing away too much power and handing it to agencies that have no real accountability, especially to Congress. And this is a bipartisan problem. Congress declares victory by handing power away, shrugging off responsibilities, the Constitution's first branch, and instead sort of reducing itself to being little more than ombudsman for the administrative state. And I think the best writing on this comes from one of my favorite legal writers, the late John Hart Ely, in a book called War and Responsibility, had to do with the Vietnam War. But I think it's very relevant to this subject. He said at the beginning of the book, in discussing the transfer of power from Congress to the executive branch, he said, "It's common to style this shift a usurpation, but that oversimplifies to the point of misstatement. It's true that our presidents generally wanted it that way, but Congress and the courts ceded the power without a fight. In fact, the legislative surrender was a self-interested one. Accountability is pretty frightening stuff." That's what I think the problem with Congress is, our modern Congress. It tries to avoid accountability by handing these problems off to other parts of government. What specifically is Congress doing that does more harm than good? Well, it casually hands off immense power to agencies and compounds that power by sitting by idly as agencies claim even more power through what we'd say in property law is adverse possession, basically allowing agencies to assert squatters' rights over powers that they never received. Congress fails to reform and modernize the laws governing the agencies, like the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. Of 1946, a seven-decade-old statute that Congress is afraid to reform and modernize. Congress understaffs itself. It cripples its own oversight powers. And I think Congress forgets Madison's exhortation in Federalist 58 that the power of the purse is the most effectual tool that Congress has for reining in the other parts of government. We saw that in Dodd-Frank in the way that it created an agency, the CFPB, that's not funded by Congress, not subject to the power of the purse. But even in the agencies that are funded by Congress, the appropriations process is a mess. It creates an annual head-on collision, a cliff, that creates a situation in which Congress really can't do anything but allow the executive branch to have its way, and that needs to be reformed. Well, let's not blame Congress too much, because maybe the real fault lies with us, with all Americans. We demand too little of Congress. We expect too little of Congress, the people that we voted into office. And I think of another author, C.S. Lewis. He said in The Abolition of Man, he said, "We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor, and then we're shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate, and we bid the geldings be fruitful." We need a more ambitious Congress. I'm not the only one who thinks that. James Madison thought that. It's the whole point of Federalist 51, right? Let ambition, we rely, our Constitution relies on ambition counteracting ambition and the interests of the office holder being attached to the rights of the place. So we need a more ambitious Congress, and we need congressmen who see themselves as congressmen and who are vested with the interests of Congress. Now, all that sounds very hopeless. I'm actually hopeful or optimistic. We've seen recent legislation, things like the RAINS Act, the Regulatory Accountability Act, which the House has passed, and maybe the Senate will too, which tries to reclaim power from the agencies, either by pulling back delegations in the RAINS Act or by updating the APA with the Regulatory Accountability Act. And I think those are both good developments. I mean, the last election cycle, which was a bewildering election cycle, I think we'll all agree, there was a very eloquent argument made in favor of conservatives voting for Trump. It was by Charles Kessler, Krista Muth, and other extremely thoughtful scholars who said that Congress had really in recent years taken on as a fundamental principle the reassertion of Congress's power in these laws. And that the sort of unusual rise of a president who wasn't as wedded to the party meant there was an opportunity for Congress to continue to assert checks and balances in a way that we haven't in the past. Again, people like Charles Kessler, Krista Muth, and even Senate Majority Leader McConnell and Speaker Ryan, I thought that was a powerful argument then, and I think it still is. And I think we have an opportunity in the bills that have been passed so far and in Congress's carrying out of its duties to really vindicate the argument of Kessler and DeMuth and others, and I hope they do. Thank you.
I'm going to take advantage of an ambiguity in the title of the panel description, which is the modern Congress doing more harm than good? And I'm going to take modern Congress to apply not just to the past Congress that seems to be the subject of the panel description, but to the current Congress, and to ask how well the current Congress is doing in achieving ambiguity. And my answer then to the reposed question, is the modern Congress doing more harm than good, is I think yes. So the notion of harm that underlies the question posed for this panel is that of unaccountable bureaucracies and delegating power to these organizations. But the unaccountability through delegation is not, in my view, the kind of accountability problem that we're seeing, at least so far, in this Congress. And the notion of accountability is itself contestable. So let me spell that out a little bit more. I think the assumption underlying the worries about delegation to administrative agencies is that the only way to achieve or to promote accountability is through the electoral process. And yet, I think that there are ways to make legislation, to pass legislation that actually is less accountable than other kinds of legislation. I'm going to give two examples here from the current Congress. One are the resolutions of disapproval under the Congressional Review Act, and the other is the pending legislation to amend the Administrative Procedure Act, what was just referred to the Regulatory Accountability Act. I'm going to explain why I don't actually think that the current Congress is helping in terms of accountability. First, the Congressional Review Act. The Congressional Review Act, as you know, limits debate to 10 hours in the Senate. There's no amendment, though, to the underlying statute under which the rule was promulgated, and a rule that is disapproved under the Congressional Review Act may not be enacted in a way that is substantially the same as the disapproved rule. And one could say, on the one hand, maybe this legislation promotes accountability insofar as Congress has to actually stand up and disapprove a specific rule, and perhaps in that way it can be held to account for the position on that rule. But let me suggest several ways in which I think that this act actually limits rather than promotes accountability. One, I think the limit on debate in the Senate prevents the normal kind of fleshing out of problems and deliberation that might attend legislation passed through the routine process. Two, it seems to me that undoing regulation without amending the underlying statute means members of Congress don't need to take the political heat for actually changing the underlying statute. They can say, for example, we haven't touched the Clean Air Act, and yet they can still undo important regulations under that statute. And this can be, I think, a maximally bad situation, actually, for in terms of accountability. The interests opposing a regulation under the Congressional Review Act are concentrated. They're concentrated on a specific rule affecting specific regulated entities in a specific way, and there's a large incentive, therefore, to press for the undoing of that rule under the Congressional Review Act. By the same token, if one doesn't undo the underlying legislation or change the underlying legislation, then representatives in Congress can still represent to their constituents, we haven't touched the Clean Air Act, we haven't touched laws relating to protection of financial consumers, and so forth. And so in that respect, too, it seems to me, accountability can be diluted. I think the same thing is true of legislative proposals to amend the Administrative Procedure Act, and here I find the Regulatory Accountability Act particularly misnamed. It strikes me that that statute, which is a fundamental change to the 70-year-old Administrative Procedure Act, that statute would pile on analytical and procedural obstacles to rulemaking, and therefore, in a quite, I think, surreptitious way make it very difficult for agencies to enact ambitious regulatory programs. Again, without changing the underlying statutes, and so that representatives can still say to their constituents, we haven't touched those statutes that you might care about. We've just made the process for issuing rules different. So again, I've changed the question to refer to this Congress, and our evidence about how this Congress will behave is obviously very, very new and incomplete. And yet, I think the early signs are not encouraging in terms of promoting accountability. Thanks.
Thank you. Good afternoon. It's good to be with you. Thanks for having me. The title of our panel is Congress, is a modern Congress do more harm than good? Seems to me begs at least two questions. One is the nature of the modern Congress, and the other is what is the harm or good of that? More questions are raised and turned by the theme of your conference, which is about the relationship between Congress and the executive branch. The modern Congress, as well as the modern executive, and the harm caused by both, it seems to me, is a function of the new form of rule created by Congress and facilitated by presidents that is coming to overwhelm us. Let me put it in the broadest perspective. If the development of the rule of law and constitutional government is the most significant accomplishment of the long history of liberty, the greatest political revolution in the United States since the Constitution has been the shift away from the lawmaking institutions to that oligarchy of experts that was earlier referred to. Congress has had the defining hand in all this, of course, though the modern executives are not at fault. The difference being that Congress's role has led to its weakening. Its handiwork, on the other hand, has created the conditions for a new, virtually imperial presidency. The result is an increasingly unbalanced structural relationship between the executive bureaucratic branch that can act with or without Congress on many occasions, and an ever-weakened legislative branch that seems unable or unwilling to exercise its powers to check the executive or rein in the bureaucracy. One only needs to read Shakespeare to see that Anglo-American history of 1,000 years is replete with the back and forth between despotic rule and the slowly developing concept of the rule of law. The full implications of this only appear in the institutions and the principles of the American founding. The key turn comes with the formal recognition, previously in theory, but first expressed in the Declaration of Independence, of inalienable rights that belong to each person by the laws of nature and nature's God, and that to secure these rights, governments are instituted among men, deriving their just powers from the consent of the governed. Consent legitimates government and underscores lawmaking by representative institutions. The form of the Constitution further separates those powers, duties, and responsibilities according to the primary functions of governing, to make laws, to execute laws, and to adjudicate laws according to particular cases, creating in turn the separation of powers. Strong, energetic government of limited authority, powers enumerated in written constitutions, separated into functions and responsibilities, further divided national and state, all designed to secure individual rights, leaving room for self-government. The modern state, on the other hand, can be traced to continental utopians of the 18th century, deeply enamored by the endless promises of reason and modern science. The late 19th century progressives took this argument, combined it with German idealism and historicism, and Americanized it to shape the old constitutional system into a new, more efficient form of democratic government. Government must evolve and expand, we were told, and be ever more actively involved in day-to-day American life. But there was also no longer any principle that limited the actions of the state. To encourage this change while directing and controlling it, they posited a sharp distinction between politics and what they called administration. Politics remained the realm of expressing opinions, hence the continued relevance of Congress to provide rough guidelines. But the real decision, the details will be made by administrators, often found in various agencies, things we call the administrative state. But they would be objective and neutral experts. And they would act above petty partisanship and faction, mostly unseen and beyond public scrutiny, to accomplish the great objectives of policy reform. We've been going down that path in fits and starts for some time. And yet, almost from the very beginning, the administrative state was bifurcated. And most of its history can be read as a battle between the president and Congress for control over it, especially after cases like Humphrey's executor in 1935 and the failure of the Brownlow Commission during the New Deal. At first, Congress had the better of the fight, with presidents and presidents tried as they could to control the fourth branch. Congress, after all, had created the darn thing. now and all these agencies to carry out its wishes, delegating legislative powers. A chief objective of the Great Society was to further centralize administration and expand those regulatory activities on a society-wide scale. Congress, again, was the first to adopt the administrative state, continuously reorganizing itself since 1970 by committees and subcommittees to oversee and interact with the day-to-day interactions of the bureaucratic apparatus. As it expanded, Congress tried as it could to keep up with its creation. But over time, Congress by default has largely come to focus on oversight and regulatory relief. Today, I would argue the primary function of government actually is to regulate. Congress writes legislation, very broad language, turns extensive power over to agencies, so we're all familiar with that. They are given authority to execute, often adjudicate violations of those regulations in particular cases. As a result, most of the actual decisions of elected legislators, lawmaking public policy, previously the responsibility of legislators, are delegated to those bureaucrats whose rules, no one doubts as a practical matter, have the full force and authority of law. And as Congress expanded the bureaucracy, creating these agencies, delegating its power, losing control in the meantime of the details of budgeting, focusing on ex post facto checks, the executive has grown to new levels of authority. And while Republican presidents mostly tried to control the bureaucracy, try as they may, Democratic presidents found it more to their liking. Now, like never before, the executive can lead a willing bureaucracy through a combination of executive discretion, poorly written laws, willful neglect and disregard toward their policy ends with or without the cooperation of Congress. Once it's established that the president can govern by executive order and regulations without Congress, it will prove difficult and impossible to prevent future executives from following the precedent, regardless of which party they belong to. This idea, I would argue, of administration is not merely an aspect of modern politics, a necessary adaptation to modern times. It's a new and all-encompassing form of political organization. It's a symptom. It's not a symptom, but it's the disease of modern government. Congress doesn't act to correct this growing tilt toward bureaucratic power, anomaly under the modern executive, the structure of government will be fundamentally altered. This imperils a constant design and the greatest achievement of Republican government. So can Congress be made great again? It may be a prudent option to assert checks and balances through litigation, but courts aren't going to solve the problem. Indeed, the notion of the legislative branch going to the judicial branch to solve its problems with the executive branch seems to me to be rather feckless. The real solution is for Congress to strengthen its constitutional muscles as a co-equal branch in our separation of powers system. Important steps around the edges are in the works. The Reins Act, APA reform, repeal of Chevron deference. Likewise, the continued increased use of Congressional Review Act is very important. But these actions are just that, mere steps, and not a substitute for actual legislative control over today's labyrinthine state. Regular legislative order, especially the day-to-day back and forth of authorizing, appropriating, and overseeing the operations of government, will do more than anything else to restore Article I powers of Congress and bring consent and responsibility back to government through better lawmaking. In one place where the power of Congress is not entirely lost, as Adam mentioned, is the power of the purse. Strategically controlling and using the budget process could turn the advantage back to Congress, forcing not only the executive to engage with the legislative branch and get back into the habit of executing the laws enacted by Congress, but also bring the modern administrative state to heel. Congress needs to think strategically and act like a constitutional institution, indeed the primary branch of constitutional government. This is especially important in the moment, when unified control of government, a conservative Congress, and a president who seems willing to confront the bureaucracy, perhaps more than any executive since Reagan, presents an unprecedented opportunity to challenge bureaucratic rule in the name of popular government. But for that confrontation to serve the ends of constitutional government, Congress needs to get its House and its Senate in order. Thank you.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here and to be on this panel with this esteemed group. As Dean mentioned at the beginning of this panel, I'm the president of the Progressive Constitutional Accountability Center. We're dedicated to fulfilling the promise of the Constitution's text, history, and values. And I am always pleased to come back to the Federalist Society because in an era in which civil and reasoned disagreement about important issues that we all care about is unfortunately increasingly rare, I'm delighted to be part of this conversation. And thank you for having me and hearing my views. So the setup to this discussion in the invitation that I was sent is President Reagan's famous quip that the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Now, Reagan was joking, sort of, and I swear that I have a sense of humor. I'm not one of those humorous liberals everyone talks about. But I'm not really for this kind of anti-government attitude, particularly because I respect and admire those who give their career to public service, as many of you in this room have at one time or another, even though it can be easy to be cynical and just bash Washington. But I swear I'm more fun than that opening paragraph would make me seem. So I want to follow up on what Professor Spaulding did, which is take a slightly broader view, because I think when we're thinking about that context of, you know, is it frightening when someone says I'm from the government and I'm here to help, the fact is that from a constitutional perspective, our framers created a constitutional system where our federal government would have the flexibility and the ability and the authority written into the text of the Constitution to act for the common good in situations where that national help would be needed. Our Constitution establishes a vibrant system of federalism that gives broad power to the federal government to act in situations where a national approach is necessary or preferable, while of course giving the states a significant role to craft innovative policy solutions that reflect the diversity of America's people, places, and ideas. With the failed Articles of Confederation and that document's feeble central government chief in their minds, George Washington, James Madison, and the other delegates to the Constitutional Convention shared a conviction that the Constitution must establish a national government of sufficient, substantial power. In considering how to grant such power to the federal government, the delegates adopted Resolution 6, which declared that Congress should have authority, quote, to legislate in all cases for the general interests of the Union, and also in those to which the states are separately incompetent or in which the harmony of the United States may be interrupted by the exercise of individual legislation. The Constitution's drafters took this charge and then, of course, wrote substantial congressional powers into Article 1. So stated simply, our Constitution was drafted to ensure that the federal government had enough power to ensure that there could be national solutions to national problems. And federal agencies have become crucial to fulfilling this constitutional mission. In recent years, Congress has taken this charge seriously, passing legislation tackling environmental issues, including the Clean Air Act, which has been interpreted to give Congress and the agencies authority to regulate climate change, healthcare reform through the Affordable Care Act, of course, but before that, Medicaid and Medicare, and consumer protection and financial regulation, most recently through the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act. Because the CFPB has been specifically mentioned and is increasingly under attack from all sides, I'd like to spend a few moments defending that body as what I think is an example, not just in that particular case, but also of the importance of the way that agencies can be part of this constitutional mission to provide national solutions to pressing national problems. In order to appreciate why the CFPB was created and how it is beneficial to the nation, we need to go back nearly a decade. As we all remember, and probably frighteningly looking at our 401ks, in 2008, the nation plunged into the worst financial crisis since the Great Depression. As the Senate Committee on Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs noted 6 years ago, from the start of the crisis through March 2010, more than 8 million jobs were lost, resulting in the highest rate of unemployment since 1983. American household wealth fell by more than $13 trillion. Retirement assets dropped by more than 20%. And more than 7 million homes in America entered foreclosure. Now, I know it's easy to let those big numbers and statistics fly by, but for every one of those numbers was a living, breathing American whose life was devastated. After more than 50 hearings dedicated to probing and evaluating the causes of this economic downfall and assessing the types of reforms needed, Congress concluded that this devastation was made possible by a long-standing failure of our regulatory structure to keep pace with a changing financial system. More specifically, Congress found that the financial crisis was precipitated by the proliferation of poorly underwritten mortgages with abusive terms, followed by a broad fall in housing prices as those mortgages went into default and led to increasing foreclosures. Enabling these dire events was, as Congress said, the spectacular failure of the prudential regulators to protect average American homeowners from risky and unaffordable financial products in favor of protecting the short-term profitability of banks. And a key explanation for this regulatory failure, Congress found, was the fact that consumer protection in the financial arena is governed by various agencies with different jurisdictions and regulatory approaches, resulting in a disparate regulatory system that has been blamed in part for the lack of aggressive enforcement against abusive and predatory loan products that contributed to the financial crisis. So faced with this national problem, this crisis, what was Congress to do? To remedy these failures, prevent a recurrence of the same problems, and create a new regulatory framework that can respond to the challenges of a 21st century marketplace, Congress in 2010 enacted the Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act, a key part of which was the creation of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. I should note that in the DC Circuit litigation that's ongoing over the CFPB, my organization represents the primary drafters, Mr. Dodd and Mr. Frank, as well as other Democrats in Congress who were sponsors and promoters of the law. We filed a brief in that case supporting the constitutionality of the CFPB. So obviously, I have a point of view here. The CFPB was created to have the independence, resources, and mission focus needed to prevent a recurrence of the problems identified after the financial crisis and respond to the challenges of an evolving financial marketplace. Congress structured the Bureau to be led by a single director serving a 5-year term, rather than a multi-member commission, to avoid the delay and inaction to which commissions are susceptible. And to insulate the Bureau from political interference and industry pressure, Congress provided that this director may be removed for good cause. That is, inefficiency, neglect of duty, or malfeasance in office, but not for political disagreements alone. Obviously, people are thinking a lot about removing directors of agencies, but I'm going to leave that where it is. Anyway, opponents of the CFPB contend that this arrangement violates the constitutional separation of powers, because it deprives the president of the ability to remove the director at will, based, for example, on a policy disagreement or simply a desire to put someone of his or her own choosing in that position. But I submit that this argument has no merit. To start, there is no support in the Constitution's text or history for the proposition that an officer like the director of the CFPB must be removable at will by the president. The Constitution does not really address the power to remove executive officers from their position, other than obviously giving Congress the power to impeach, and the topic of removal was not discussed in great length at the Constitutional Convention in Philadelphia. Although the Constitution provides for executive officers to, as George Washington wrote, assist the supreme magistrate in just discharging the duties of his trust, setting forth a small number of rules regarding their appointment, removal, and responsibilities, there are few textual limits imposed by the Constitution on Congress's ability to structure administrative government. The framers ensured, however, through the necessary and proper clause, that future Congresses would have the flexibility required for shaping the government to the demands of changing circumstances by granting Congress the authority to, as we all know well, make all laws which shall be necessary and proper for carrying into execution powers vested by this Constitution in the government of the United States or in any department or officer thereof. Indeed, participants in the Philadelphia Convention rejected a plan that would have enumerated specific executive departments and prescribed their duties in the Constitution itself, partly out of a desire to leave to successive Congresses, through the medium of that necessary and proper clause, the flexibility required for shaping the government to the demands of changing circumstances, as administrative law expert Peter Strauss has explained. Now, as Chief Justice Marshall observed, this clause, like the Constitution itself, was intended to endure for ages to come, and consequently to be adapted to the various crises of human affairs. By contrast, he said, to have prescribed the means by which government should, in all future time, execute its powers, would have been to change entirely the character of the instrument, resulting in an unwise attempt to provide by immutable rules for exigencies which, if foreseen at all, must have been seen dimly and which can be best provided for as they occur. In sum, the Constitution was drafted to ensure that our federal government has the ability and the flexibility to provide national solutions to national problems. In exercising these powers, the Constitution gives Congress significant power to shape the structure of federal agencies and to give their leaders a degree of independence from presidential control. The framers deliberately provided such flexibility to Congress so that future lawmakers could respond effectively to new and unforeseen national crises. Congress exercised this discretion after the devastating financial crisis of 2008, making a considered decision that an independent CFPB, led by a single director, could best combat the types of consumer financial abuses that caused the near collapse of the American economy. Congress had every right to make this choice. The Supreme Court has long recognized that heads of regulatory agencies may be shielded from removal at will, and the CFPB is materially indistinguishable from the agencies addressed in court's prior decisions. Thus, the Bureau's leadership structure is constitutional. Now, getting back to Ronald Reagan's famous quip, I would suggest that if you're one of the 27 million consumers who were compensated after the CFPB went after misconduct by big banks and got more than $11 billion in relief, not to mention one of the millions of Americans who had access to quality, affordable, secure health care under the ACA, or a person of color, or a person of faith, or a woman who is protected by enforcement of civil rights laws by our agencies, when someone shows up and said, I'm from the government and here to help, you probably breathe a sigh of relief, not react in terror as Ronald Reagan would have it. So thank you so much for having me. I look forward to our discussion.
So we have floor mics on either side of the room. If you have a question, you can approach one of those microphones and let us know you have a question. I want to give this side of the table a chance to respond to what followed from their remarks. But as you do that, it seems to me that one thing that keeps emerging here is our issues of accountability. I'm wondering if is it axiomatic that the exercise of power should be accompanied by accountability? And if that's the case, how do you rank these various institutions of government in terms of their accountability to the people? And I'm thinking of where does Congress sit, where are the courts in terms of accountability, and where are the agencies, and is it fair to pair the agencies with the president, or are those severable entities You know, I remember a statement by President Obama with regard to the IRS scandal that he had no control over the IRS. He couldn't really influence them. I'm paraphrasing, obviously. And then the issues of removal power. But where would you put those? I mean, Justice Scalia, obviously, I think, in his support of Chevron, for example, thought that the judiciary was perhaps less accountable to the people than were administrative agencies. So.
I think some of this depends on what one's notion of accountability is. As I suggested, one notion would be simple accountability through the electoral process. But if you think of accountability more broadly, then I think it could be argued that administrative agencies are the most accountable institutions in the governmental system. They are not subject to the abuses of money and politics in the same way that the members of Congress are. They have, in some ways, a much bigger public-facing aspect to them. They hold public hearings. They meet with people constantly. They're constantly in touch with people who are affected by their rules. And at the end of the day, they have to give a reasoned explanation for what they do. They have to explain, on pain of being overturned by the courts, they have to explain why they're doing what they're doing. None of those, that requirement is not applicable to our elected representatives. And so if you take a bit broader view of accountability, then it strikes me that administrative agencies may well be at the top of the list.
I mean, it's hard to overstate how profound my disagreement with all of that is. I mean, I think what you're saying is agencies are the most accountable because they have to sort of smile politely while they receive comments, and then tell the people while the people aren't going to get what the people are asking for. When it comes to accountability, nobody said it better than James Madison. I hate to quote him over and over again, but he said, "Yes, Democratic politics, Republican politics is messy, but there was a remedy for that." And it wasn't an administrative remedy, it wasn't a technocratic remedy, it wasn't even a judicial remedy. It was a Republican remedy, lower R, although we can debate about that too. But at the end of the day, we were trusting politics to solve these things. There's so much flight from politics right now. So many issues that want to be taken away from politics and put into the courts to be decided or put into agencies. And it's the same problem. At the end of the day, Congress is, in its design, the most accountable, truly accountable branch, and it needs to remain so. Congress needs to be the center of our political gravity. The executive branch has energy, but at the end of the day, Congress has to have the gravity in our government. And any single agency might be justified. I don't disagree with that, except for the CFPB. But any agency might be justified on its own. The first Congress struggled greatly with how to create the initial agencies. But you have to step back and look at the forest for the trees. What we have is a collection of agencies, an administrative state, I'd call it, that has now become the center of gravity in our politics. The president can walk away from legislative debate knowing he has his agencies. Members of Congress can walk away from these debates. It has become the center of gravity with this gravitational pull on our politics that's deforming our politics and undermining our ability to govern ourselves. So I disagree.
Matt or Elizabeth, anything on this point?
I just underscore what Adam said. He used the phrase I was going to use, the missing the forest for the trees. I mean, the whole setup of the American system is to be a Republican remedy to the problems of a Republican government. We need more politics, not less, so that we have more accountability. The idea that accountability can come from the benign expertise of those that aren't elected and aren't responsible through election is a deep violation of democratic theory, which is why I think something like the CFPB is a real problem. Any agency that is self-funded and set up to be virtually unaccountable, setting aside whether you think its policy outcomes are good or not, violates that notion of accountability. And again, and Adam is right, the accumulation of all these things has become something, so I can say this as the only, as far as I know, the only political scientist on this panel of legal minds. Sometimes we have to point out the obvious. I mean, you know, Caesar has crossed the Rubicon here, right? The way we govern ourselves has radically changed in this government, and we need to step back and take a much broader view. This government and most of the operations that affect most people on a regular basis, is not susceptible to their opinions, which is why, surprise, surprise, we're getting a politics which is increasingly upset by people like Donald Trump. There's a lot of pushback against this form of government, and I don't blame the American people for trying to figure out how to change it.
Elizabeth Weiner, you're leaning in.
Yeah, I think, you know, there's an obvious accountability here, which is Congress. You know, you don't like that the CFPB is independently funded. Congress can change that. You know, vote in people who will change that.
But
if
the
you don't
law says
like
you can
it.
Only change it on Saturday when the moon is full, right? I mean, the way it was written.
Well, you don't think you can actually do that? I mean, we're letting Congress off the hook here. I mean, I think that is the answer to a lot of these things.
I agree
instead
with that.
Saying that, you know, we have this thing we can't do anything about. Look, I think a lot of these things are, I think a lot of agencies and what they do are important. So I'm going to vote for people who are going to make sure that I have clean water and clean air and safe food. And, you know, if there are things that you don't like about the CFPB, then you can exercise your accountability measure at the ballot box and get people voted into Congress who support that. I think that's a clear constitutional piece of accountability.
Right, that I agree with completely. Congress should get rid of the darn thing.
Look, that's, you know, that's the American people speaking. I think they shouldn't. So, you know, that's how it works.
I think, Elizabeth, if you listen to the tape this morning from Senator Mike Lee, you'll find, as the saying goes, you're in violent agreement with Senator Mike Lee. Let's take a question from this side of the room, if we could.
Yeah, I happen to disagree. I don't think you fellows have presented enough of what the real problems are and what the possible solutions can be. I worked for a Nixon administration several years ago, and I was in charge of trying to optimize healthcare and education. And one of the things I learned is that the government every year makes millions of decisions about approval and denials of immigration, social security, et cetera, and tens of thousands of major decisions about health, welfare, food, everything we eat. Congress is not competent, is not qualified to make the tens of thousands of important and millions of daily decisions. It's barely able to make 3 or 4 decisions a year that make some sense. So I think the Constitution had it right. Congress passes the laws and POTUS, the agencies, execute it. The real problems are not in the issues that you brought, but I think the problems are that the people who are in charge, or at least some of the people who are in charge of implementing the Constitution, are not perhaps suitable for their intended jobs. They're not quite competent. And I think the real rules should be that Congress should make the optimization rules. You talk all about accountability. You cannot have accountability if you don't know what you're optimizing. What is important for me to accomplish, which is for me to get $10 billion from each one of you, is probably not the same as what you want to accomplish. So if you don't have an optimization rule, what you're trying to accomplish, you cannot have anything to measure. So Congress should say, this is what we're trying to accomplish, this is the optimization rules. Maybe something like the president's
I think we've got it here. Adam or Matt, you want to take a first shot at that?
Well, I don't think the claim here is not that Congress should do everything and there should be no regulation at all. The American founders were laid out of an argument for regulation. Mm-hmm. But to remind us of what Hamlin says in the Federalist Papers, right? The idea that the government is best administered is best is a heresy, right? The problem is that the extent of administration and delegation has gone to a point where I think it both violates in principle and form how the government is supposed to operate. Yes, you need agencies. Yes, you need people who can do particular things. But unless Congress is on top of it, year to year, day to day, through its budgetary process and other powers it has, that thing is going to go off on its own. The one thing that Madison was absolutely right about, which is still true today, is human nature. That's why we have a Congress to keep an eye on it.
That's great.
Lisa or Elizabeth? I'm going to push back a little bit on Matt on the human nature argument. And Adam, you invoked the Federalist 51, that power set against power. It seems to me that's failed fundamentally in Congress. I think you pointed it out yourself, Adam, that it might be human nature to accumulate and then exercise power, but Congress has done exactly the opposite. Unless you can get yourself to a point where you think that the thing itself, the office itself, is the power, and that everything Congress is doing, individual congressmen and women, are doing is to preserve their term in office and to get reelection. They're not exercising power.
You keep quoting Madison over and over again, and now I can't remember which number I want to cite. So it's one towards the back. We talk about the Madison and the founders recognize that we're all imperfect, and we need a government that's going to be run for imperfect people by imperfect people. But Madison also recognized that our Republican government presupposes, and greater than any other form of government, a basic level of Republican virtue and civic virtue. And that's why I ultimately focus not so much on Congress, but on those of us who elect Congress, because I think we need to focus more on how we see our government, how we see each other, and how we see the people we're electing to that government.
Lisa?
I'll quote Madison, too. If men were angels, no government would be necessary. Right? So a basic purpose of government is to control human behavior and to keep people from hurting other people. And so a question arises when we look around and we see that we have agencies that perhaps we think have gone too far. We'd like some delegation, apparently, but not too much. Then a question is, what branch of government should be correcting that? And I think that it's turned out to be very controversial and seldom done to have the courts be the corrective to the over-delegation of power to administrative agencies. And so I think, to some extent, this panel is in agreement about Congress should do more in this regard. They're ultimately the people who hold the power. I find it ironic and sort of actually astonishing when one goes to testify in Congress about a statute that's under attack in Congress, let's say the Clean Air Act. They're very, very upset if you throw something back to them and say, you know, you all have the power to change this. If you don't like this statute, you have the power to change it. That's just never a popular thing to do at a congressional hearing. And that's I think, what we're all saying to some extent is what should happen.
Let's take a question from over here.
I've listened to all the panels this morning, and it seemed to be that the entire discussion is the shortcomings of the Congress. In fact, your panel's title is "The Current Congress Doing More Good or Bad." My question is, why don't we ask the same question of the executive branch? As bad as the administrative state is, and as large as it is, and I have some familiarity with that, one of the biggest problems is the growth of the federal deficit. I hadn't heard, maybe you have, anything in the last election by either a Democrat or a Republican to address the size of the federal deficit, nor in most of the other debates and other elections. So my question is, if I ask the panel, is a modern executive doing more harm than good? I think I would be interested in your response to what you think of the executive branch participation and ability to address the problems, because most certainly, I think the nature and magnitude of the federal deficit is every bit as big as the growth of the administrative state. And I applaud the Federalist Society for addressing the size of the administrative state, but it appears that most people in Washington really don't care about the level of the deficit. And the president can't control it, but he most certainly can be, any president, be the bully pulpit to correct it. And I'd be interested in your views of whether you think the modern executive is doing more harm than good.
I'm sure our panelists are qualified to speak about that if they're inclined to. On the Federalist Society website, we've undertaken that question before. This conference was designed with a different purpose in mind, but I'll give the panelists a chance to respond.
So I raise that in my paper. The way I see it is that Congress, they've already done their harm, and now they're virtually a worthless institution until they get their act together. But in doing so, they've turned this apparatus over to the modern executive, and a modern executive's still have the one key to human nature that Adam mentioned earlier, ambition, which means they can use that for good or for ill, for good or for harm. And I think we're seeing that in recent presidents who can use their pens and phones. So I would worry about that. But again, it points back to Madison's solution, right? It's to make those two branches compete with each other. And right now, Congress is pulled out of the game, which leaves an open road for the modern executive.
I have frustrations with all three branches of government. I could get into the judiciary, too, if you'd like, but I agree. I mean, the executive has problems of its own.
But keep in mind, the point here is that the thing we've called the administrative state does not exist in a vacuum. We have this interesting phenomena where there are two regimes existing in the United States at the same time. There's this new regime of administrative regulatory procedures, and there's this old constitutional regime which is trying desperately to get control of the other one, and they're fighting over it. And right now, Congress is losing that battle, and the executive is figuring out how to do it, and the courts are increasingly getting involved in that, too.
Actually, can I make a serious point?
Yes.
You know, people in the federal society know that when the Supreme Court in the mid-20th century began to make the Constitution its sort of exclusive province, the problem wasn't just that the court expanded its work, but that the other two branches started to lose the ability to speak in the language of constitutionalism. And I think something similar happened with the administrative state. The executive branch asserted more and more power over the administrative agencies for very good reasons, beginning with FDR all the way through Reagan. But the cost of that was that Congress lost the ability to speak the language of administration in the same way, right? It ceded too much, I think, to the executive branch. And I think that's another important dynamic that needs to be corrected.
I think we should be careful about worrying about executive power only when our executive is not in office. And I've always thought, or thought for a very long time across administrations, that we've ceded too much power to the president, and too much power to the president under statutes that don't give power to the president himself, but give power to the executive agencies. And so I know that many people in this room will disagree with that, but I'm always surprised at how the Federalist Society is so concerned about power, unchecked power, and yet has developed such robust arguments for giving so much power to one person.
Well, in fairness, the Federal Society has an entire Article I project. I mean, then it continues. And I'm a big fan of it.
But I would say I would also make the distinction between the argument for a unitary executive, which is what are the proper constitutional powers of the executive, especially when it comes to questions, say, of national security, that come out of the vesting of the presidential power to the executive, and this other thing, which are these other powers which have been delegated away from Article I that the president is now using to control vast areas of government that they're not supposed to be controlling, at least not
but
less
we're in,
Congress.
When you're in a situation that we face, which is a large administrative state, when one part of your argument is not working, and granted you're making it about Article I and Congress's obligations, but when that argument is not working and has not worked arguably ever in our constitutional structure, then I just wonder about the other project, about the project of presidential power and giving that much control to one person.
My point is they're consistent if the objective here is actually restoring constitutional authority to its proper order.
Another question from this side.
Thank you. Another area where Congress has been giving up a lot of its powers and a lot of the control has been actually war powers. And we have seen the example with the recent airstrikes in Syria, which generated some outrage and some discussion from a few of the usual suspects among the Republicans, but mostly has died down because a lot of people supported the policy as a policy and did not really look to closely examine the legal aspects of the situation, which for experts was somewhat dubious. What is the level of the discussion among the Federalist Society and among the experts pushing for reassertion of congressional control over the fact that there's been a significant deterioration in congressional involvement over the years?
I would point out that it's consistent with the argument I was making that the most important power Congress has over war making or national security is through their normal legislative powers, through budgeting, through controlling expenditures. And that's what they're not doing. I think that the executive, I would make a unitary argument about the power. The executive has extensive powers, legitimately, that don't stem from the legislature when it comes to national security matters. Having said that, I mean, I'll leave the Syria question aside for right now, I guess.
Another question.
Thank you guys all for the fascinating discussion. I wanted to especially thank you, Elizabeth, for coming and doing this talk at the Federalist Society. And I especially wanted to praise the first half of your talk and then raise a question about the second half. So I think it's actually very good to be reminded as conservatives that the Constitution wasn't just created in order to restrain government actors and to protect rights, but also to enable the federal government to do certain things that it couldn't do before. I think that's absolutely right, and I think that we as conservatives often forget that. But I think because the Constitution was going to be instrumentalist in this way, the framers wanted to channel that power through certain processes. And so, for example, as a conservative, I don't think a progressive America would be unconstitutional. I mean, there might be some arguments that it could be, but I don't think it would be necessarily unconstitutional. What we care about is process. So we do care if a progressive America is imposed through a CFPB rather than a vote of Congress. So I think maybe your talk conflated those two things, the instrumentalist nature of the Constitution and the processes through which the instrumentalist nature is supposed to be channeled. So I'll turn this into a, turn it on its head and ask the question of actually Adam and Matt. How much do we as conservatives really actually care that it's agencies doing this instead of Congress? If 100% of what agencies are doing today was enacted by Congress, would we really be any happier? So do we really care about process, or do we care about federal government power? What's our true motivation here? I guess, is it Wickard v. Filburn instead? Or I'm just not sure what our actual motives really are.
Okay, I'm perfectly comfortable to disagree with both the process and the substance. But I'll grant your point, right, that when Madison said, or no, so abuse deciding, I'm wrong one. When Hamilton said that energy in the executive is a leading character of good government, he stressed it wasn't just in foreign affairs or national security. He said it was in the steady administration of laws at home where an energetic government is important. And I do think sometimes as conservatives, I overlook that part of Hamilton's equation. And so I'm glad you do point that out. Like I said, the first Congress, one of the first things they did was create agencies, right? And so we do need agencies to administer the government. And there's going to be, as Scalia said in the Mistretta opinion, there's going to be inherently policymaking in that administration of government. So I can't easily draw a bright line, but I do think now we're well beyond it, whatever it is.
Thank you so much for that question. I think that the question with the CFPB is, you know, whether you think it's unwise as a policy matter, in which case, of course, that's not a constitutional problem, that's a political one, or whether the constitutional objections to it are valid. And, you know, when we looked at the textual limitations on what Congress can do, the historical limitations, the way that the Supreme Court has interpreted that, that part of the Constitution, there didn't seem to be a basis for the constitutional arguments to the CFPB. Now, you could say that that is because there's been a growth in the administrative state that the Congress has been complicit in. That's a political problem, but I don't see it as a constitutional problem.
That was a good question. But actually, your comment there gets precisely to the heart of the matter. If you don't see something, you see a political problem, but not a constitutional problem.
I don't see a political problem either. I'm just saying that some of y'all might.
But the point is, the change in how the government operates is a constitutional problem. And I don't speak here in legal technical terms. I actually don't care whether this court or that court said this or that. I think as citizens, we have to see that it's not operating in a way that resembles, for a long time now, what we would broadly call government based on consent. That's not a process question, that's a question of justice. And I think that goes to the heart of what America means and what it is trying to show is possible in modern forms of governance. And I think if we miss that as conservatives, if we spend too much time in the weeds and we don't see that that's what is at issue here, we will lose this before, and it'll be too late at a certain point. We're not there yet. Right? That's why we need more politics to have these battles. The advantage of having something not done by an agency in the dark that takes long time to come out and is hard to debate, enforcing it into the legislature, again, Madison's argument, is when you force in the legislature, you have what? Public debate. There's deliberation, and you have politics. Right? Mm-hmm. Aristotle said that's a form of reasoning. That's a good thing, and that means we're going to talk about what is just. And that's what we ought to be doing, and that's the end, as Madison said in the Federalist Papers.
This might be our final question.
So this question, I think, is mostly for Adam and Lisa. But
could
I
you
guess
get closer to the microphone?
Sorry, this question is mostly for Adam, especially, and I guess Professor Heisenling as well. Since you touched on financing these agencies, on appropriations, President Heisenling touched on accountability. And so I wonder if at least an easier first step solution is to have however many appropriations bills we have now, 13, and they're, you know, there's these enormous bills, state justice and something else gets rolled into one bill, as opposed to having, you know, 57 or however many, where EPA gets its own appropriations bill, and FTC gets its own one, and if it gets bogged down, so be it. And then the accountability problem is that depending on which side of political divide you're on, you can run around the country and say, those, you know, no good Congress people, they cut the legs under from your favorite agency, and now we can't have clean air or something else? Or if you're on the other side of political divide, saying, can you believe that they're spending your hard-earned tax dollars on funding X, Y, and Z, when we should be reducing deficit, building up military forces, whatever, right? Would that at least help Congress rein in control back of these administrative agencies?
I mean, we really just have one appropriations bill now, right? I mean, every year it's just a big omnibus. But you're right. In theory, there's a dozen or so appropriations bills. And that process, which is pretty modern, was created for a reason. It was created to correct problems that preceded it. So I'm hesitant to suggest just, you know, off the cuff, big revisions to that. But I do think the basic point is right. The fewer appropriations bills there are, the less the money is tied to what the agencies and the rest of government are doing, right? And set aside the fact of these giant face-offs we have once a year over the bills. I think that divorcing the appropriations process from the oversight process has real problems that are ever more apparent. And I don't know how you reconnect the two. I'm not saying hand appropriations powers to the subject matter committees. But I'm saying we do need to recognize the cost of divorcing the appropriations from the committees that are overseeing these agencies and find a way to realign Congress's power with Congress's responsibilities.
I don't have a problem in principle with trying to make individual representatives' votes count on appropriations by perhaps making the separating agencies' appropriations. I don't have a problem in principle with that, but let me just say that if you're looking to budgetary decisions to rein in agencies, then I think there's a potential accountability gap there too, which is that you leave the underlying statutes in place. The statutes have promised clean air and clean water and safe medicines and safe food and on down the line, and then you starve the agencies so they can't deliver on those promises. And then the question becomes, who's responsible for the failure of those agencies to deliver on their promises?
That's a fair point. The statutes are the statutes, they're the law, they're the supreme law of the land, and they should reflect national policy. But sometimes I'd suggest that statutes are, as far as policy goes, statutes are what economists would call stated preferences, and appropriations decisions strike me as something much closer to revealed preferences. And if there's an increasing gap between what Congress wants to pay for a policy and what they say they want in a policy, that might say more about the underlying statute and how far afield it is from real national policy than we currently give it credit for.
It makes the underlying statutes a lie.
But it also points out the extent to which the modern budgetary process in Congress itself is a terribly bureaucratic and inefficient process. I mean, the fact that we have it used to be 13, now we have, 12 appropriations bills, has no connection to any rational principle. They can have as many as they want, they can do it in whatever order they want, and they can use it for strategic leverage if they chose to. The process too often is tying Congress down from making the kinds of decisions, going back to underlying legislation if they chose, that they're not doing now, and it's no surprise then that they just choose not to do it and it ends up in omnibus bills. It shows you the extent to which Congress itself has become part of the administrative state. They've adjusted themselves to be, to parallel, to model, to mirror the administrative state itself.
Yeah. I mean, Lisa and I could probably argue on this all the way out the door into the taxi cabs, so I don't want to belabor the point, but I wouldn't say the statute is a lie. I'd say the statute is a good faith statement of aspirations. Right, and as time progresses and we get further from those statutes, whether it's the Clean Air Act that's 25 years old or the Communications Act that's almost, 80 years old, the appropriations process, I think, becomes a much more clear statement of experience and our new policy views in light of experience. And it's unfortunate if they're increasingly divorced from statements of aspiration from a quarter century or three quarters of a century ago, but I think they're our present reality.
I think we're going to have to leave it right there. Please join me in thanking the panel.